welcome everyone to another episode of the Dine Sports Podcast on the Dine Sports Podcast Network. Today, we've got two phenomenal guests coming your way. Up first, we've got New York Times best-selling author, Chris Clary. You might recognize him for some of his U.S. Open and tennis coverage that he's been doing for years now for the New York Times. He's got a new book out on Roger Federer. So we break down not only his new book and all the amazing things that Roger has accomplished over the course of his career, rewriting the history books and being one of the most influential figures in tennis today, but we also discuss the recent U.S. Open, Naomi Osaka, and what happened with her, some of the amazing runs that all of the Canadian men and women had at this year's tournament, Layla and Felix and everyone else, tremendous, tremendous stuff. So we break down some of that and more. So a really interesting interview with him, especially if you're a tennis fan. Then we've got John Shipley, who is a beat reporter for the Jacksonville Jaguars, joining us today to talk all things Jags. Finally, the Jaguars are relevant on a national level again. They've got Trevor Lawrence, one game under their belts, probably a game they'd like to forget, but we've at least got a sample size of what this new look Jacksonville offense and defense has in store for us this season in meaningful NFL football. So you can only take so much away from preseason games and mini camps and training camps and OTAs and all of that. It's when the pads go on and the scores actually count for the standings, that's when you really get a real glimpse of what people are going to be like at the professional level. So again, very cool conversation with him. So let's get right to it. Up first, we've got Chris Clary from the New York Times talking all things tennis and Roger Federer. Joining us on the podcast today, he has a new book out. He's the New York Times tennis correspondent, Christopher Clary. Chris, how are you doing today, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. Thanks. Just got over to the U.S. Open and had an amazing tournament there. So I'm just kind of decompressing here, talking about the book. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a great place to start, too, because the U.S. Open obviously just wrapped up. Us being a Canadian podcast and having you on it, I would be remiss if I didn't at least get your thoughts on the run that some of our homebred Canadian men and women had at the U.S. Open, and maybe who even just impressed you the most with the runs that they went on.
You mean the North American Open you're talking about, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not the U.S. Open these days. Between Bianca winning it in 2019 and Layla getting to the final and Felix getting to the semis, I mean, it's been all Canada down there. No, it's been great to see. I think it's been a long time coming, and I've been following it obviously as a tennis writer and have seen the, you know, the progress that your elite players have made. It's been Layla, for people that are not following the game week to week, think she comes out of the blue. Well, obviously she does not. She's been a long time improving and obviously emerged in her mid-teens there as a great junior player and has been able to build on it. So, and I'm a huge Bianca Andreescu fan in terms of just her tennis and the way she plays the game and the upside of her game if she can get healthy, which is obviously her big challenge. Felix and Dennis, we'll see. You know, it's going to be interesting because those guys are, especially Dennis for me, I mean, I'm a journalist. I wouldn't want to pay money to watch a lot of tennis players at this stage, but I would actually pay to watch Dennis. I just feel like the guy's got this flashy, wonderful game. Love the leftiness, love his ability to create power, and he's so explosive. Felix is more of a smooth, you know, balanced kind of player. Not as flashy in that regard, but I mean, talk about four players. Jeez, I mean, great talent. I do think the women probably have, in my view, more long-term upside if they can stay healthy in terms of maybe winning Grand Slam titles and really contending at the highest level. It's going to be pretty dense for the men with Felix and Dennis up against these young guys who've already emerged and won Grand Slam titles. So we'll see, but hey, you know, between right now, Canada and the big cousin down to the South, I think Canada's winning the tennis race right now.
Yeah. Hey, we'll take it. And like Layla said, maybe it's the maple syrup, who knows what it is, but clearly cranking out some tennis talent that were competing on the world's largest stages. So really nice to see, but obviously another massive storyline that sort of came from the U.S. Open, and you actually wrote about it in the New York Times, was Naomi Osaka, obviously not having a lot of fun playing tennis right now, possibly stepping away from the game. Now, we won't try and speculate, you know, when or where she'll come back or anything like that, but for the casual tennis fan who might only tune into, you know, the Olympics or a Grand Slam event or something like that, might have shocked them a little bit, but for those that are in the industry and are watching, you know, these players day in, day out, is this something that you guys have maybe noticed looming for a little while, that there were some real struggles going on here?
Well, I think Naomi in particular, I've been following her progress for quite a while. She was somebody I think who when you watched her win Indian Wells back in 2018, which was kind of her big breakthrough, much like it was for Bianca Andreescu in 2019, you could see when she gave her victory speech, it was just uncomfortable for her. That public eye, that public speaking, that role as a spokesperson, you know, was going to be difficult for her. She really had to, I think, do a lot of work on herself to feel comfortable with that. And then she got put into a position where she became a star by winning the US Open, beating Serena in the final in 2018. And suddenly a huge interest in her from sponsors because of her multicultural background, and got put in a position where she had a lot of opportunity. And of course, you're going to grab that. And I think she also realized that she had a big platform. But I'm not sure that for her, in terms of preparation, in terms of where her natural inclinations are, it was the easiest transition for her. And I'm not going to speculate about everything else that's going on. I mean, we know there's a lot of issues with mental health with the younger generations right now for a lot of reasons. I don't know the extent of that with her. Obviously, she's having struggles with just the game and finding her passion for it and her way with it. Amazing talent. Has really proven herself, obviously, on hard courts. You know, not so sure about the clay and the grass at this point, but in terms of her hard court tennis, I would say the best women's player in the world at the moment in a lot of ways. So much to play for. If she can find her niche, find her way to cope with these sorts of things, I don't think it's about the news conferences, frankly. I think it's about much more than that. And she needs to find her way in this very exposed sport where, you know, basically you're only as good as your last match in a lot of ways. I mean, it's such a vulnerable thing. And there's so much focus on appearance, so much focus on many aspects of how, what kind of person you are and what you present to the public. I mean, it's a tough road, and it'd be tough for anybody at any age. And think about these people in their teens and their early 20s having to, you know, be these prominent people in the social media world. You know, it's a lot to ask. It needs a lot of preparation. So we'll see how the sport reacts, and we'll see how professional sport reacts, because these are new pressures. People have always had star issues trying to cope with that. You look back to people like Bjorn Borg and Jennifer Capriati, and, you know, it's not always been easy for sure. But now you're basically everybody in the world who follows you can chime in with their opinion, and you got to find a way to block that out or deal with that. And also, you've got gambling, which is a big issue now in terms of the impact it has in terms of the reaction on social media. People who've put a lot of bets on tennis can react in real time. So there needs to be more education with the players, needs to be more protection of the players. And I think there needs to be more of a concerted effort. And I think it's coming in tennis in particular about making sure that people, as they enter the sport, realize where those, you know, rocky shores are, because they're pretty rocky.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, an all-world talent. We wish her all the best. Hopefully we do see her back on a tennis court sooner rather than later. But first and foremost, you know, get yourself right. Sports will come later type thing.
But I would say this, and that is, and maybe you want to talk about this too, but I think it's interesting to see what the sport has gone through in the last couple of months, particularly seeing Naomi's struggles and not getting a lot of joy from tennis. Mm-hmm. The great thing about this US Open was, I think it brought people a renewed sense of, you know, the power of positive things that tennis can bring. And just to see the joy of Raducanu and Leila Fernandez and their runs, and the kind of delight that it brought to the crowd, and just the feelings that it engendered in the people that were following the tournament, it was just a tonic. And I think it just really gave the sport a huge lift.
That women's final was electric there. And I mean, I don't know what you were doing at 18, 19 years old, but I certainly wasn't competing on the world's highest stages like they were. So definitely youth being served in a huge way at this year's US Open. Flipping over to the men's side, though, we've got Medvedev upsets Djokovic in straight sets, even, to end his bid to become the first man in almost 50 years there to win all four Grand Slams in a calendar year. Now, considering how dominant, if we go over the last decade plus, really, that Djokovic, Nadal, Federer have really been, everyone's always been wondering, okay, when sort of that next wave coming? Do you think we're finally approaching, maybe we can see the shoreline, you know, they might still have a little bit left in the tank, those big three, so to speak, in tennis, but that next generation is ready to grab the reins and run with it? Or do you think that that experience still has a few years left of dominating most of the major tournaments on circuit?
Yeah, I think we're kind of in the hybrid model right now, if you will. But for sure, no, I think you're seeing what's happening already. It was visible at the non-Grand Slam level. I think at the Masters 1000 level and the Master at the 500 level, ATP 500, you were seeing guys like Medvedev and Zverev and others, get the big titles at that stage. They just hadn't broken through at the Grand Slams, except for Dominic Thiem at last year's US Open. But then you didn't have Federer and Nadal there, and Djokovic eliminated himself by getting defaulted. So this was the first tournament where at least one of the big three was there in the final, obviously with everything to play for, and one of the younger generation knocked him off. And not just knocked him off, but, you know, beat him pretty soundly. A lot of reasons for that. But I think definitely you're going to see, you know, a more balanced situation now going forward, where some of the younger generation are going to be able to pick off more of these titles. And you're going to see, I think, guys like Djokovic and I think Nadal, maybe on clay, if he can get healthy with the foot, still going to be factors for the next couple of seasons for sure. But the guard is changing, and it should. And the history of tennis would normally tell you that it would have already happened. So we're in this exceptional period where it hasn't happened for so long, and these same guys have dominated. But I mean, just watch the matches. You watched Zverev play Djokovic in the semis. If you watched the final, Novak wasn't at his best for sure. But Medvedev has the tools, especially on hard courts, to do consistent damage against the very best players in the world. And I think that's just the way it's going to go. I mean, these guys are only going to get better, and I don't think Novak and Rafa are going to get any better. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all you need to know.
Well, if we focus on the book there, obviously one of the big three is the focus of your newest book, which is The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer. And it's available everywhere now. Now, being a New York Times writer yourself, was it a little bit weird to open the newspaper and actually see your name on the New York Times bestsellers list?
It was such a lifetime high for me. You know, I mean, I've been writing 1,000 word articles for 30 years, you know, day by day, and I'm enjoying it, love my job, but it's just a whole different situation with the book. I mean, you really, it's all of you, you put out there. It's so much time. I mean, it's, for me, basically this was 20 plus years in the making, this book. I've been dreaming about it since I was a teenager, you know, writing a, you know, a real solid full book. Mm-hmm. So to actually get it done after all this thinking and frankly, dreaming, you know, it's not, I want to exaggerate, but that's kind of what it was, to finally get it to happen and then to see it hit that list. I mean, geez, what a wonderful thing for me. And, you know, however long it lasts, however many it sells, it's just great to see that kind of reaction to it. And I think the timing was good, because Roger is obviously coming near to the end of his career, or near the end of his career. And I think people are really in a mood to look back and appreciate what he's done. And the book is kind of written in that sort of valedictory, nostalgic tone. And it really isn't just about Roger. It's a book about this whole era in men's tennis. So, you know, I think I felt the timing was right. I didn't want to be premature about it, but I felt it was a good time to look at it, because it's been an amazing era. And Roger is the thread, the main thread in the book. And he's the one I've followed the most. But I think if my goal was, you know, 5-10 years down the track, if somebody wants to pick up a book to understand what made these guys tick and what made the era special, hopefully my book would be on that list of books they'd want to read about that.
Yeah. And we've had a few authors on the show, and people tend to go one direction or another after releasing a book like this. They either say, oh, I can't wait to get my claws into something else, or never again. That was the most torturous experience of my life. Have you sort of settled on one of those two ways, or are you just enjoying the ride for what it is right now?
Look, I'm not going to lie. I mean, it was the hardest thing I've done, you know, no doubt. And I covered a lot of major sports events in my career, many different sports besides tennis. Covering an Olympics from the beginning to the end is pretty challenging, you know, definitely in terms of sleep deprivation and just using all the words you got in your internal vocabulary. But this was the hardest thing, just because it's a big subject. He's a very prominent person in sport, means a lot to a lot of people. I know him well as a journalist. I wanted to do it justice. So I felt a lot of pressure doing it. And I also wanted to bring something new to it. I mean, he's a known quantity. He's been out there for a long time. So have Nadal and Djokovic. And I wanted to learn a lot doing it myself, even though I've been around them a lot. And that was one of my goals. So that just all those things made it challenging, and having not done it before. I mean, long form is, as you probably know, I mean, it's just the biggest challenge is structure. Mm-hmm. You're trying to figure out, how do you organize all these connections, interviews? How do you organize all these locations? Try to find a way to do this era justice and not get bogged down in a million forehands and a million backhands. And so that was challenging to figure out the structure, and then had to be adjusted on the fly. And it just seemed like, in a lot of ways, what I really I found to be the day-to-day challenge was just, in our business as sports writers, you have a certain amount of time each day, or maybe a couple of days, to put your story together. And I've long ago come to peace with the idea that I can't be perfect, and that I've got to just get it done in the time that I have and then move on. And I can live with that. And in a way, it's a great excuse, because, you know, you didn't have any more time. Deadline has arrived. It's got to go out into the world, and whoever wants to read it will read it. But with a book, you have so much time. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a situation where it's, is it ever good enough? Are you ever happy with it? So I think that's what it is. And ultimately the deadline comes in book writing too, thank goodness, but it's a lot longer out there. So it was just a great, great challenge. And so I think the answer to your question roundabout fashion, yes, I'd like to do another one, but I can't say it was like a joyride from start to finish because it wasn't.
Now, something that coaches will always preach to youth athletes and all that coming up, and regardless of what sport it is you can't really flip a switch. You have to always be preparing yourself for the next event, for the next match. It doesn't just go on like that. But something that's always struck me about Federer is just how private he is off the court, how calm, easygoing he seems to be, always cool, calm, collected, all of that. But then on the court, he manages to turn into the Terminator at the drop of a hat, it seems like. So in speaking with those who know him best, and even Roger himself, like, what did you sort of take away from that experience as far as trying to explain how he's able to flip that switch when the lights are their absolute brightest and all eyes are on him?
That was one of the most interesting things in going back and reporting out this book, was to see his process and how he did that, because it really wasn't his nature. And this was a guy, I mean, most people who follow tennis and, you know, a little bit older as well, have followed it for a long time, know that Roger had an issue with his temper when he was younger, that he was a bit more volatile. But I didn't realize to what degree it was really a problem for him and how much it was holding him back. And you know, a lot of coaches early on, people in junior tennis, knew he had this amazing ability with his shot making, obviously a great athlete, great mover and everything else, but they felt that his emotional reactions to tennis were going to hold him back and maybe keep him from being a great player. So that was really one of his biggest challenges, aside from just learning how to construct points and play the game well, was to figure out a way to manage the emotions. And honestly, you know, the more you think about it, a lot of great players over the years have been held back by these issues. And tennis is such a frustrating game because you can never perfect it. And if you have that kind of personality where you want to perfect it, you're going to always be frustrated. And I think Roger had just a lot of trouble accepting his errors, accepting the defeats when they came. And there's stories in the book of him when he was young. Basically, they'd be playing junior events. He'd be underneath the chair umpire's chair in Switzerland and still crying after the matches were over. All the other kids had taken their box lunches and gone off to hang out in the clubhouse. And Roger's still out there, you know, having a hard time coping with it. And I just think he had a really difficult time finding a way to do that. And I think the book, you know, when he writes his autobiography, which I'm sure he will someday, I know that'll be a big part of it. And he can go into all the processes of his mind and how he did it. But I think I have a pretty good understanding of it now. And you know, he definitely did it with a lot of different tools, and it took him a long time. I'd say that sort of 1998, when he won Wimbledon junior title at age 16, to 2003, when he won Wimbledon, the real title, for the first time. That five-year period was very important for him in many respects. And that was kind of when he found a way to dominate, change his approach. And ultimately, sports psychology helped. He had a sports psychologist, I think, working on himself. He lost somebody very close to him. Peter Carter, his childhood coach, died in 2002 in an accident in South Africa. And that definitely was one of the most pivotal moments in Roger's career. And all that sort of shaped his mentality and I think made him realize what he needed to do. And that was, you know, there are guys, and we've seen him, you can look at Djokovic, that can blow off a lot of steam and still be great players. Roger, I think, realized he couldn't do that. And not only that, he didn't want to do that. That wasn't the image he wanted to present to the world. I think he wanted to be somebody who gave that gentlemanly, you know, more zen-like image to the world when he played tennis, because he knew he was going to be a lot of replays, a lot of looking at his game through a microscope. And I think he just decided that was not who he wanted to be. But ultimately, he had to suppress a lot of things in him to create that, what you talked about, that that image that you see of him. And one of the interesting things in this book was talking to some of the younger people who follow the game now, podcasters in their 20s and readers in their 20s. They really didn't know this. The Roger that they know is the Roger that, you know, the final product. Yeah. Kind of Zen master. Yeah, he's got occasional blips. Racket might get tossed once in a while, or a shout, or a word he shouldn't use, but amazingly, you know, together for a guy who's been in the public eye that long, that's all they ever knew. So for them, that's been a real revelation to go back and realize, wow, this guy made this progress and how far he came. And I think that's one of the most interesting parts of the book, and his own path is just how he did it, how hard it was, and that the guy we're seeing out there, you know, he really had to change himself and maybe not play to who he really is, when he's playing his matches, he had to find a way to kind of tamp that part down to bring out his best tennis. So I think everybody's a bit different, but that's what worked for him, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you just said there, we're talking about late 90s going all the way back to when he was at the highest levels of the junior sport. So he's been in the public spotlight forever. Obviously, a very successful athlete, tons of awards, money, fame, whatever it is you want to name. He's probably been there, done that at this stage of his career. What do you think still drives him now at this stage of his career? Is it legacy? Is it something else? Like, what is it that gets him out of bed ready to compete against the best in the world day in, day out at this age?
Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, Roger seems smooth and cool, and I think he is in a lot of ways. He's got a, you know, he's a very engaging, charming guy in person when you interview him. Somebody's got a lot of empathy and charisma. It's not as polished as he might seem. And you talk to him, he's can be goofy, and he's not always in English. It's not always making total sense, but it's got great energy, you know.
Yeah,
great guy. But I think he's a competitor, and don't forget that, because you know that the guy that was fighting himself and having a hard time with losing when he was a teenager, that's still in there, huh? Mm-hmm. That's driving him. He doesn't like to lose. He's a deeply competitive guy. This is a guy, one of the most amazing things about his career is that he has never still retired from a match mm-hmm. at any level of professional tennis, which is unbelievable.
No.
He's played 1600 matches and never has he pulled a hamstring. He's had back injuries, things that hang along. He's never stopped. Once he starts a match, he finishes it. And I've seen him obviously in times when he shouldn't have finished it, but he did. So that whatever that is in him that makes him do that, that is a driving strong force. So as cool as he can look, the guy's got grit and the guy's got fight and the guy, and that, so he enjoys the competitive aspects of the sport for sure. And I also think over time, he became an ambassador for tennis. I mean, Djokovic, you could argue quite convincingly, I think is on paper has had a more successful tennis career now, even though they're all tied at 20 Grand Slams each. I mean, Novak across the range of achievement in men's tennis now probably has more boxes to tick than Roger does. But you look at Roger's whole role in tennis. I mean, the guy has carried the torch for the sport for a long time and done an enormous amount of good for the sport in terms of the people he reaches and all across the world. And I think he's taken that to heart over time. And I know from talking to him that communion with the public, which for him is not just a Swiss or European or Canadian or American public, but really a global public. I followed him all over the world. And this is pretty much the same case wherever he goes. That means a lot to him. And I think he gets a lot of joy and a lot of pleasure out of that. Much like a guy, you know, if you're Led Zeppelin or the Stones or whoever you are, and you're hitting the road and you're getting that connection with your public, that keeps you going. And I think for him, that grit, competitive aspect, the fact that he just really has developed a deep connection with the public. And the third thing I think is the guy just likes the feel of the ball and the strings. He likes the feeling of practicing his craft. He's never burned himself out. Something he told me, he goes, I've never been burned out. And I think that's been very intentional on his part, something we can all learn from. He's understood himself, what his limits were, when he needed to kind of pull back. He talks about this clenched fist image a lot. He uses this when we talked about tennis a lot. And he says, you can only keep your fist clenched for so long. Mm-hmm. You got to relax it at some points. And it's very, very important to be intentional about when you do that. So that was one of the most interesting things, and spent a lot of time with him over the years. And I think he's right. I think that's why he was able to play until he was, we'll see how he does now, but he's 40 years old, but definitely into his late 30s, and to be very successful because he understood, you know, when and when not to clench.
Absolutely. And I mean, obviously you've been covering not only Roger, but tennis in general for a long time now. And, you know, what's something that maybe didn't make the book, but is just a good example of a story or an incident where this is what separates Roger from his peers? This is why he's different. Does anything jump out to you that maybe didn't make the final cut?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty long book. So a lot of things made the cut. Yeah. Maybe I should have been a few things that didn't make the cut, actually, as it turns out. But if you ever get through it, or if you get through it, you tell me. But I feel like, one of the stories in there that is really interesting is just how he handles some of the things that people in the sport tend to think of as drudgery, I would say. You know, a lot of the top players, they love, you know, competition perhaps, or they enjoy the fruits of their labor, the money that it brings and all those sorts of things, maybe the adulation, but not so many of them probably get a big kick out of interviews when they become too numerous, or news conferences, or sponsor appearances, or internal politics of the ATP. And, you know, I'm not sure Roger loves those things. He's a people person, no doubt about it. Some guys are not. Some guys, that drains them. Roger, he gets a lot of energy from it. But I think Roddick, Andy Roddick, who was great for the book, one of the best interviews I did for the book was with Andy, gave me a lot of time and a lot of great insight into Roger and their own rivalry at the time back in the earlier 2000s. He talked about when Roger came to do a charity thing for one of Roddick's foundations after Roddick retired. These guys stayed friendly. Mm-hmm. Another sign of Roger's kind of character is that these guys he's played with and beaten up on still like him. I'm not sure that's always the case.
Yeah.
So he's managed to manage those relationships pretty well. So he goes, you know, shows up at these, at this Andy Roddick Foundation thing in Texas, flies in. Roger's still an active player, still in his career. And he shows up and basically says, "Hey, I'm here. What do we need to do? Tell me about your charity. So I don't just know, I want to know exactly what you're doing so I can talk about it intelligently. And let's go in there and do this." And didn't ask, you know, when am I supposed to be done? Didn't in any way, the guy just plunged in, something that would have been drudgery for a lot of people, I think. Did it with joy. And Andy said, like he said, he thought he'd be chaperoning him around, sort of talking to him. This is this person, you know, da 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 da, kind of helping him through. He said Roger just left him after about 5 seconds, plunged into the crowd, started talking to people, questions, answers, completely natural. One guy with donor had twins. Roger's got two sets of twins, as you know, comparing twin notes. Just, you know, and I guess in a sense, you know, you and me, we're average people. So if one of our friends did this, not that they'd be in a sponsor situation, but this is kind of how average people would react and it would be normal. Superstar athletes, they get the credit for being normal, I suppose. But it's true. I mean, they get catered to. It becomes a different set of rules, different set of expectations. And Roger, I think one of his great things, and Andy points this out, is he just, his process, he kept it normal and relaxed. And I think he liked that. And I think it came very naturally to him. And so he basically, you know, they went through this whole day of sponsor thing. It's time to go. Roger's stayed longer. His flight got delayed, went back in the room, started talking to people again some more. It just was a very revealing thing. You know, Roddick, just to see a guy like Roddick, who's also a star, knows the situation. He was just blown away by the way Roger handled the whole thing. And the guy's got his faults. He's not a saint. The book hopefully doesn't give that impression, because he's not. But he does a lot of things well. And one of the things he does well is when he does something, he does it with good energy and intention, and he's present. And frankly, in this world of, you know, distracted living that we're all in, and superstar athletes getting catered to from the age of 7 or 8 till they retire, it's refreshing and I think edifying to see somebody do it a different way.
He's certainly a unique in that respect for sure. But we've got to remember, too, this is someone who recently turned 40. He's going to be undergoing knee surgery. Now, do you get the sense that he's saying, "Oh, I'm coming back for sure. I'm definitely coming back." Is that because he's just such a competitive person and he wants to come back and leave the sport on his own terms as opposed to going out because of an injury? Or do you think there's an outside chance we might be seeing, you know, a second act to Federer's career here, a la maybe a Tom Brady down in Tampa Bay there, and we've got some more juice left in the tank, so to speak?
That's a great question. You know, I hesitate to count Roger out if he believes in something. I feel like Tom Brady needs to drop back and release a pass and make great decisions. Mm-hmm. Roger has to drop back and run like crazy for 3 or 4 hours in a Grand Slam match with spurts of speed and hand-eye coordination on the fly against a bunch of young guys coming for him. Not quite the same physical challenge, I would say. There have been tennis players who have in their early 40s been able to do pretty well. Guys like Pancho Gonzalez back in the day, or Ken Rosewall for sure. But, you know, I just don't see it myself that he's going to be able, best of five tennis, to come back and win Grand Slam titles anymore. But hey, the guy has proven that he has his grit. He's proven he loves the game. If his knee surgery can be done in a way that he's able to come back healthier than he was at last year's Wimbledon, or this last year's Wimbledon, when obviously he was not right when he played on a bad knee, he lost the last set of a straight set loss in the quarters to Hubie Hurkacz, 6-love. That's not the way he wants to say goodbye to the sport or to Wimbledon. I know he doesn't. Mm-hmm. But the only problem is I'm not so sure that you get to pick your end game, or that you're not guaranteed to have a better ending if you come back. But if he wants to come back and play healthy and feel like, you know, he's giving it a real shot and not being limited, you know, who can begrudge him that? I can't. I just don't see him winning Grand Slam titles anymore at this stage. Can he come back and have a great Wimbledon maybe if he's feeling it because of his grass court expertise and he's 100% healthy? Why the heck not? But what's he playing for? If that's what gives him meaning at this point in his life and that's what he wants to do, then, you know, I think it's great. I don't think that's going to happen. That's just my educated guess at this point. And I don't think he has anything left to prove. Would have been great for him. I'm sure if he would have beaten Djokovic at the Wimbledon final in 2019 with the two match points. I mean, I know that's got to be still in his brain somewhere. And he's right. That would have been the ultimate.
No.
And he was right there. Matter of maybe an inch on a first serve that would have been an ace that hits the tape instead. So, you know, that's a tough thing to deal with. But there's so many things that he has done over the years that are good and positive. So I think in the end game, he's got to feel pretty good about the calculations he's making about what he's brought to the game and what he achieved.
For sure. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today. We could talk tennis with you for hours, but for those that are listening that want to either connect with you on social media, see your articles, pick up a copy of the book, where are the best places to find all things Chris Clary these days?
Well, you're nice to ask. Thank you. I mean, I'm on Twitter a lot. I use it to communicate with my readers and also take some constructive criticism, it being Twitter.
Yeah,
I've developed a thicker skin over 10 years of using it, for sure. But I think generally people have great attitudes, and I appreciate the input and the suggestions. But the book itself is, you know, one of the great things and gratifying things about it is it's gotten a really global release in a lot of ways. And we have 16 foreign deals for the book in a lot of different languages as well. But I know in Canada, it's been out for a couple of weeks now, and the reaction so far has been wonderful. I am always somebody who encourages people to support independent bookstores if you can. If you need to order it online, great. But if you have the wherewithal to do it and don't mind spending maybe a little bit more money, you know, pick it up in your local bookstore and support those community-based things. I think that's a great way to go. And I hope you enjoy it, whoever reads it. And, you know, feel free to let me know through Twitter what you think.
Amazing. The book, it's out now. It's The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer. Go and pick up a copy today. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much. We'll be watching the Canadians dominate the tennis world here. So I appreciate that.
All right, before we get to John, I want to remind everyone to head over to our friends over at mybookie.ag. Better yet, head over to dinespressbox.com, check out a couple of our articles, and then click on any of our banners to take you over there with pre-populated links and referral codes. MyBookie has some of the friendliest lines on the internet. So whether you like single game bets, parlays, future bets, or more, they've got a little bit of everything for everyone. Just make sure you use the promo code DINESports, D-Y-N-E-S, sports with an S at the end of it, when you are making a first deposit, claiming a bonus, or even doing a top up on your existing account. Tonight, we are going to be going with the Tampa Bay Rays to defeat the Detroit Tigers, and we're going to say the Washington football team will hold court at home and take down the New York Giants in a little Thursday night football action. Feel free to follow along with us or
do your own thing.
More power to you. All we ask is that you must be 18 or older. Please gamble responsibly. And if you have trouble gambling, please take advantage of some of the resources online that MyBookie has provided to point you in the right direction. Now, let's get to it with our friend John Shipley and the Jacksonville Jaguars. Joining us today, we've got beat reporter for the Jacksonville Jaguars, John Shipley. John, how are you doing today, sir?
Hey, man, I'm doing fantastic. How are you guys doing?
We're doing really well. Just watched an exciting college football weekend, an exciting NFL kickoff weekend. So lots of football, lots to unpack as well with the Jacksonville Jaguars, because, I mean, obviously coming off three consecutive losing seasons, and yet last year was obviously a season to forget about. You know, you guys go out there, you draft Trevor Lawrence, you bring in Urban Meyer. Maybe let's just start with this. Is there finally a sense that the team is heading in the right direction and truly building a lasting product here for the first time in a while in Jacksonville?
There was a sense of that, at least, you know, before they went out and lost to the Texans by several scores. I do think within the building there is a bit of a, probably, you know, at least, you know, within the Jaguars fan base, I think probably the Jaguars fans are, you know, a bit less ecstatic than they were about the direction of the team moving forward, particularly, you know, really the direction of the team at the top of the organization, you know, in terms of the coaching staff, the front office. I think the one thing that fans and, you know, people, especially inside the building, are still excited about is, you know, Trevor Lawrence. I think no matter how, you know, bad things may look at any point, Lawrence at least having his high level flashes that he had. And, you know, he probably had more mistakes than any of the other two rookie quarterbacks who started games last week, Mac Jones and Zach Wilson. But his high level flashes and his peaks are just insanely high. You know, his touchdown throw to DJ Chark, you don't see many quarterbacks in the NFL who are going to make that throw, you know, into that hole against cover two. So I think there's still a ton of excitement around them in terms of, okay, we feel like we have the quarterback, and that's the biggest question. Now, what else can the Jaguars do moving forward? At least from, you know, my objective view, you know, as a beat reporter, I think it's tough to make any long-term conclusions after, you know, one game or anything like that. I think definitely the vibe in the offseason was that, okay, they have, you know, a better coaching staff around. They have better ideas for the players, you know, on and off the field. And they have a front office that is at least potentially more, you know, in tune with the coaching staff than the last regime. But so far, you know, through at least 1 week, if there are going to be any overreactions, it's that a lot of the offseason moves they made, you know, are just weren't impactful. You know, they got very little contributions from their rookie class outside of Trevor Lawrence. And that's in part because, you know, Travis Etienne's season-ending foot injury, but also in part because, you know, their second-round pick, Walker Little, he was a healthy scratch. If your second-round pick is a healthy scratch, you either made a bad pick because of the player or you're mismanaging the team. And from what I saw in the preseason and training camp, it's more probably so the latter. I don't think Walker Little is a player who's a liability and, you know, should be, you know, week one of the season. So just things like that. I think I brought expectations probably down a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, you just mentioned it there. Obviously one game does not make an NFL career, but Trevor Lawrence goes out. He has 332 yards passing, 3 touchdowns, 3 picks, a bit of a mixed bag. Obviously pretty disappointing to go and lose to the Houston Texans, 37-21 in the fashion that they did. But what were just your initial takeaways from Trevor's performance and just the Jacksonville offense side of the ball in general?
Yeah, no, I thought the best way I've been able to put it is Trevor looked like a rookie quarterback who was placed in the middle of a team that went 1-15 last year. You know, yeah. I think people expect him to, you know, maybe come in and look like, you know, peak Andrew Luck right away and just kind of completely transcend the offense. And, you know, to a degree, when you're the consensus number one overall pick, those expectations and that pressure is going to be on you no matter what. But I thought, just considering, you know, he's a rookie quarterback and the NFL is really, really hard for rookie quarterbacks, I thought he made some throws that should leave people really excited. You know, not even some of the touchdown throws. He had one throw in the first half. It was, I believe, 3rd and 17 after, you know, a penalty or a negative run. And he hits DJ Chark for a 20-yard gain after stepping up in the pocket after, you know, both defensive tackles beat the guards for some pressure. And it was just a dart into a tight hole in coverage for a 20-yard gain. Third and 17 isn't supposed to be a down where you feel like you have a chance. That's normally when the offense waves a white flag. But with Lawrence, when they got into those third and long situations, there was at least a feeling of, okay, maybe they can convert this. And it's strange that he actually looked better. The higher difficulty the throw, it looked like he was getting better at. You know, his throw to Chark, his touchdown, his throw to Manhurts for a touchdown, the throw I just mentioned, 33-yard gain to Marvin Jones, all high-level difficulty throws that he made look easy. But on the flip side, he also made some of the easy things look hard. You know, Jaguars allowed a lot of pressure, and he did a good job of handling that pressure. But he also missed some throws from a clean pocket. You know, and I've seen a stat go around where people have credited the Jaguars offense with 7 drops. And, you know, there's probably 7 instances where the offensive skill player had a hand on the ball. But there's also a time where, you know, the quarterback's throwing a fastball behind the tight end who's cutting inside. I'm not exactly counting that as an accurate catch or a drop. So, you know, there were several instances of that. On the other hand, you know, there are probably 3 instances where I do think the offense let him down and did drop the ball, and the offensive line truly did not play well. And when you put all that together with the offensive game plan just not looking like there's any real rhyme or reason, and the fact that they came out looking unorganized, you know, they had, I believe, 2 illegal formation penalties, one because the receiver was on the line and he wasn't supposed to be, and another because the left tackle was backed up too far back into the backfield, and then they had 12 men in the huddle. So just little things like that. There are some high level flashes from the offense, especially as a downfield throwing offense, and they used a lot of play action. But overall, I think there was certainly some level of concern with, you know, the consistency both around Trevor Lawrence and from Lawrence himself, and especially with the penalties.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I don't think Jacksonville was the only team who was suffering from a bit of disorganization on opening weekend there. The Eagles, the Falcons, the Vikings, like, I don't know how many flags were getting thrown around those games, but
it looked like a fourth preseason game for a lot of teams. It was weird to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I do want to touch on, and I swear we will talk about other things other than just Trevor Lawrence here, but I do want to at least bring up something that you just mentioned, and that's the sort of Andrew Luck comparables. And there's been lots of, you know, who does his skill set remind you of? I've heard everything from Andrew Luck. Man, I even heard a Doug Flutie reference not that long ago. So it's a bit of a all over there, people trying to project people. Now, as someone who watches this team a little bit more closely than the average fan, does his skill set remind you of anyone in particular, or is it kind of one of those molds that we already mentioned?
My pre-draft comparison for him, and this is just from an on-field skill set, you know, not talking anything about the actual intangibles playing quarterback, but just from a skill set, my pre-draft comparison was a more athletic version of Matthew Stafford, you know, a guy who, you know, maybe isn't always the most accurate guy in the short passing game, but somebody who's incredibly tough in the pocket and somebody with truly a cannon for a right arm. It was weird to me in the pre-draft process. You know, you saw a lot of people hype up things like Zach Wilson's arm strength, and it kind of seemed like Lawrence as a physical talent kind of got moved into the back of people's minds. But this is a guy with incredible levels of, you know, physical talent. He has, in my opinion, a rare arm talent and a rare arm strength. And I see a lot of Stafford vibes with him. And I know a lot of people see that, you know, as a negative, but Stafford is a guy who was drafted number one overall. Team just traded multiple first-round picks for him. You know, in a lot of cases, Stafford goes to a better team than the Detroit Lions. You know, we probably look at him as, you know, one of the better number one overall picks in recent years. So that was really my pre-draft comparison for him. And seeing Lawrence more and more on the field, I haven't really changed from that. He's kind of honestly been exactly what I expected. You know, like I said, his high-level throws are high-level. You know, he's going to have some mistakes just like he did at Clemson. And that's in part because, you know, he really takes that big play opportunity really at every chance. And when you have that, you're going to have a guy who struggles, but he also makes some tough things look incredibly easy, just like quarterbacks, in my opinion, like Stafford do. So that's really been my comparison. And then when you look at him as a leader, I think just as a leader and as somebody who can, you know, kind of bring his team together and somebody who knows a game and can digest the game as well as he does, he really does remind me of a guy, like, just in terms of off-field quarterback ability, a guy like Peyton Manning, you know, just his ability to lead. And it's funny I say that because Lawrence's, you know, idol growing up was Manning. So I really do think he's taken a lot of cues from that. And just everything you hear about Lawrence from his teammates, from his coaches inside the building, it's incredibly, incredibly good.
Jacksonville goes out and drafts Travis Etienne, obviously Lawrence's bestie, college roommate, all of that good stuff. Unfortunately, they lose him for the season before the season even kicks off. So we'll have to wait till 2022 to unwrap that shiny new toy in Jacksonville. The coaching staff really had him lining up in all sorts of different positions, two backs on the field. They had him in the slot. They were marching him all around. Like, how big of a blow really was losing Travis Etienne, even though he was just a rookie coming into this offense in year one?
I think it was a big blow because you're not seeing any real threats in the middle of the field or the short area. You know, they have guys who can line up outside, DJ Chark and Marvin Jones, who can win downfield. And, you know, that LaVisca Chenault's a good slot receiver, but they don't have anybody they can just kind of get a mismatch on against a linebacker, you know, throw the ball to underneath. And that's really why pre-draft, I thought they'd be really high on guys like Kadarius Toney and guys like Rondale Moore and, you know, guys like Travis Etienne. So I think when Etienne, you know, got injured, that took away a big, big speed element and home run threat element to the Jaguars offense. And I think you saw that a bit in week one where, you know, they weren't really moving the ball unless it was chunk plays. And he was set to be one of their best players, you know, in terms of getting those chunk plays. I do think he would have played more running back than receiver, but in on that, you know, same page, I think a lot of his work at running back would have been in the passing game. You know, a lot of design screens, a lot of design routes with him against linebackers. So I think losing him definitely did impact the offense, and they didn't really have a logical replacement for him because him and LaVisca Chenault, you know, contrary to what many believe, they were never set to play the same role in the offense because they're not the same players. You know, they're two incredibly different type players. So they're missing a lot with Etienne now.
He goes down. Jags bring in Carlos Hyde. They've still got James Robinson, but they've also got some other running backs who not that long ago, you know, the organization was pretty high on. How do you see this backfield sort of shaping up as the season progresses? Is it going to be, you know, the 2021 version of the James Robinson show, or do you see it more running back by committee this year? How is that looking these days in Jacksonville?
I mean, until we see the Jaguars lean on Robinson again, I'm just going to assume that he's going to be, you know, splitting touches with Hyde. It was interesting to see how their touches really turned out because, you know, obviously Robinson had a few carries that were negated by penalties that would have made it a lot closer. But Robinson played, you know, more than 25 snaps more than Carlos Hyde did. So he was on the field a lot more. It wasn't a question of who their starting running back was and who the number one running back was, but they just did not give him the ball. And I think a big part of that was they so quickly went pass, pass, pass to start the game. And once the game wore down, you know, maybe they want a veteran running back in there. But until we see the staff really lean on Robinson, like we saw the last staff do, it's going to be hard for me, you know, to project him as that workhorse back. Because, I mean, even with Etienne's injury, everything the Jaguars did this offseason said, you know, they didn't love James Robinson as their lead back, you know, from the Hyde signing to the ETN pick for whatever reason, you know, despite his rookie season. And I think a big part of that is, you know, Meyer's kind of obsession with, you know, speed and that big play element. And Robinson, you know, for as talented of a back he is, he really isn't that guy. So Robinson, you know, logically should win out, you know, the number one role just by being a better player, but it remains to be seen.
Now, DJ Chark coming off a hand injury, played week one, saw 12 targets, only caught 3 balls. The Jags are saying he's fully healthy, but, you know, eyeball test would maybe indicate he's not quite back there yet. Like, what have you noticed? And is this going to be maybe something that he needs a couple more weeks to just get up to speed? Or do you think he's playing through an injury still at this point?
I don't think he's playing through an injury. I think it's a case of this was his first live action in, you know, a long time. You know, he had, I think, 2 padded practices before he got injured, and you know he was dealing with an injury late last season, so you know he had essentially his entire training camp preseason wiped out by the injury. And you know he returned to practice, you know, maybe a week before the game, but he still had non-contact jersey on at practice. You know, he had just started catching passes, you know, I believe the week of the game. I believe Meyer said on Monday that he had caught practice balls at practice that day. So I think it's just a case of, you know, he just hasn't really been back for that long. You know, he looked like a guy who's been practicing for a week. And, you know, I think a lot of it was just his timing with Lawrence on a lot of plays, you know, especially on some option routes, just wasn't, you know, really in sync. And I think that's what happens when, you know, you miss a lot of training camp in the preseason. You know, you're out for so long. I think you're going to see those type of things. So I wouldn't look at it as a season long type thing. I would just think, you know, maybe they need more time together to kind of get into a rhythm.
Switching sides here, let's talk about the defense a little bit. Obviously, the Jags have spent some high draft picks on the defensive side of the ball in recent years and only managed 1 sack and gave up 37 points to the Texans in week one to a team who a lot of people have penciled in as probably selecting first overall in the next NFL draft. Is this cause for concern, or is this just a weird week one blip and they'll right the ship eventually?
I think anytime you allow 37 points in a game, it's cause for concern, whether it's, you know, week one or week 17. And I think especially cause for concern because, you know, the starting defense had trouble in terms of pass defense in the preseason. You know, Jameis Winston and, you know, the Browns backup offense with Case Keenum both found success against the Jaguars starting defense through the air. So I think it's definitely cause for concern. I think if there's one thing to be concerned about with the Jaguars for this season right now, it's the pass defense, just because, you know, for whatever reason, they are on the receiving end of so many big plays that look like, you know, there's such an improbable chance of it being completed, but it happens. You know, they just have no margin for error and they've slipped at a lot of big moments. So I think there's any one part of the team that should have some definite concern about it. It is the defense. You know, Josh Allen had a solid game. He had 4 pressures, I believe, a sack, a tackle for loss. I thought he had a solid outing against Laramie Tunsil. But then you look at a guy like Caleb on Chaisson, you know, who was one of those recent draft picks that you referenced. You know, Chaisson, the biggest issue he's had both dating back to last year and this year is, you know, he's gotten better in terms of getting disruption and getting pressure. He can get into the backfield. You know, he's a high effort player. He's quick. He's able to slip under blocks, but it's actually finishing on the play. You know, the Tyrod Taylor and his 52-yard completion to Brandon Cooks with 12 seconds left that later led to a Danny Amendola touchdown against Tyson Campbell. Chaisson came unblocked off the right side, missed at Taylor once and then had a second chance to sack him and missed at him again. And then Taylor ended up rolling to his left, finding Cooks for a big gain. And there was another play where he slipped into the backfield against the pulling guards, and he had the running back right in the hole for, a 3 or 4 yard loss, but missed the tackle. So, it's just things like that, he needs to work on. So I think when you look at the defense, both dating back to the preseason and what we saw in week 1, I think there should be some genuine concern, especially, they have a rookie defensive coordinator. It's not like a guy who's an experienced coordinator who has shown everybody in the NFL that he's able to get a defense out of this funk. That was Joe Cullen's first ever regular season game as a coordinator.
Do you think it's a matter of, okay, the previous regime brought in players to play a certain scheme and that's not meshing well with the new defensive coordinator scheme? Or do you think it's just going to take a little bit of time to build up that continuity and familiarity with what they're trying to do under Urban Meyer's staff?
Levon Chaisson is a better fit for the new scheme than he was for the last scheme. I would actually say they have personnel that's much better equipped for out of place other than, probably Tyson Campbell. What I think it comes down to is, they have a lot of guys who, you wouldn't see as top tier starters on other teams. I can't imagine there are many other teams starting Andrew Wingard at safety, especially in a man coverage heavy scheme. There's not a lot of teams that are going to have a guy like Tyson Campbell in the slot. Not a lot of teams are going to have Damian Wilson playing 75% of the snaps, or, Taven Bryan, Jahad Ward as your top two reserve defensive linemen. Just things like that. So I really do think it's a talent issue more than anything. And especially in a scheme where, like I said, it's very little margin for error because it's a man coverage heavy scheme. Everybody is man to man. There's very few zone, very few double teams. And when you have it like that, just, 1 yard separation can become a big play.
Now, as nice as the additions all were in this offseason, the Jags are realistically still a couple of years away from realistically competing for a championship. What do you sort of see as their window to compete? Like, is it 1 year, 3 years, 5 years down the road? Like, when do you see that window starting to open a little bit?
It's going to sound callous, but I need to see them go through a game being able to properly line up for all four quarters before I can say they have a window. They look so sloppy and so disorganized in week 1 that I the sample size is so small for me right now that I know it's not going to be anytime soon. I think Lawrence is talented enough that he can overcome a lot of the bad things going on around him, both, personnel wise and in terms of coaching decisions. But I just think until, the coaching staff shows, more that they're really kind of cut out for this, it's hard to project the Jaguars as a team that's, 1 or 2 years away, because, you just watch week 1 and they're a long way off.
What would you say is the number one thing the Jaguars are missing right now? Like, let's say whether it's free agency or via the draft next year, you could have one add. Is it an O-lineman? Is it a secondary help? Like, what's that one key piece that they need to upgrade the most at in order for that window to compete to realistically start being within reach?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'd say it'd probably be a blue chip talent along either the defensive or offensive line. They have some good players along both, but they don't really have any one dominant player. They don't have any player who can kind of take over a game, or any offensive lineman who they know won't be an issue throughout any game. Their tackles are inconsistent. Their interior line is normally solid, but against, the Texans, AJ Kane had one of the worst games of his career. Brandon Linder got hit for a bad holding penalty, so at the end of the day, you have three veterans along the middle of the line who, are solid, but none of them are really, otherworldly. They don't have any Zach Martins or Quentin Nelsons. And then defensively, Josh Allen is by far the best player on the defensive line. And I think he's a terrific, talented player, but I don't think anybody is going to be putting him, into the top echelons of, the defensive line in the NFL right now. So I think just having a blue chip talent on either the offensive or defensive line would truly go a long way.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today. For those that are listening that want to either connect with you on social media or check out some of your articles or any of that stuff, where are the best places to find you these days?
Yeah, no, you can find me at Twitter. It's @John_Shipley. I'm aware of too many underscores. There's a longtime sports writer in Minnesota named John Shipley. So when I can be a writer for 50 plus years like him, maybe I can take an underscore out. And you can also find us at Jaguar Report or si.com/NFL/Jaguars.
Amazing. Well, we'll see if the Jags can bounce back for week 2, but the bar has been set pretty low as far as improving on week 1. So
it's a tough matchup, man, with Vic Fangio and a good Denver Broncos defense against a rookie quarterback. I'm I'm not high on Denver's offense, but I mean, Fangio just feasts upon rookie quarterbacks. So I saw the Texans favored by 6.5 points on the road, and you don't see that very often.
All right, John, we appreciate it. Go and check out all of his articles. Give him a follow on Twitter, and we'll see what the Jags can get up to for the remainder of the 2021 NFL season. And that's a wrap for another episode of the Dine Sports Podcast on the Dine Sports Podcast Network. As always, a huge thank you goes out to both of our guests today, John and Chris, for sitting down and talking all things Jacksonville Jaguars and U.S. Open, as well as his new book. Make sure to go and check out all the cool stuff that both of them have in the works. If you haven't already, be sure to like, review, subscribe, follow along on any of our social media channels. All of our handles are all the same. They're all at Dine Sports, all one word, D-Y-N-E. ES Sports with an S at the end of it. Check us out, interact with us. And if you're a fan of fantasy football, check out the Dynasty League podcast. Weekly episodes coming out all the time with amazing content to help you dominate your fantasy football leagues. They've also got a very cool episode coming up shortly where they'll be taking questions from fans just like you guys. So make sure you get your questions in for their mailbag episode. Until next time, folks, stay safe. We'll see you in a bit. We'll be right back.